Something has changed about the politics of Silicon Valley. It used to be the case that all of tech was essentially suffused with liberal ideals. Things like openness to immigration, open net optimism, disruption, and just socially progressive values in general. These were the norm. But the left has changed, and Silicon Valley has too. Some of Silicon Valley's most prominent figures and firms have turned away from the center-left coalition they once helped lead. Now they've embraced free speech absolutism, anti-woke rhetoric, and increasingly conservative posture towards tech regulation and culture. Some Silicon Valley execs are giving more to GOP-aligned causes and candidates, while others are openly registering their disapproval with Democratic Party-aligned causes. And think pieces warn of a tech right that sees big tech not just as an economic force, but a political one, pushing for things like less oversight and increasing alignment with conservative populism. My name is Jerusalem Demsis. I'm the editor and founder of The Argument, a magazine dedicated to revitalizing liberalism for the 21st century. On this podcast, we bring together people from across the political spectrum, from socialists to conservatives, to talk about the most important issues of the day. My guest today is Jasmine Sun. She's a former tech worker who now writes about the culture of Silicon Valley and AI. The argument is against subtweeting. We state our opinions clearly and we engage with our opponents directly. For an ad-free version of this episode, you can become a subscriber at theargumentmag.com. Jasmine, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
I am so curious about many things about your background, but I want to start with where we just met, because we were just both at the Progress Conference in San Francisco.
Yes.
What was your vibe of the occasion?
I thought that the Progress Conference was the most East Coast thing I've ever been to at Lighthaven.
Really?
Because I don't know, have you been to other Lighthaven conferences?
I hadn't been to Lighthaven before that. Is it like different events usually?
Lighthaven is a weird venue space that is like kind of a mix between a hotel and a conference space, but it's like mostly outdoors, kind of in a garden, and it's owned and operated by a bunch of Berkeley rationalists.
Yeah.
I've mostly been to other rationalist adjacent conferences at Lighthaven, and so Progress Conference was the first time I had seen so many button downs and slacks and people who could make eye contact. It was
kind of
weird. I mean, it was fine. It was a lovely conference.
And what to you is East Coast?
Pants, like okay, with pants belts. East Coast. Yeah. That's East Coast.
You're the one wearing a pant. Are you have a belt on right now?
Yes.
Okay,
and it's because
pants or belt.
Well, this is because I literally bought this because I came to DC for an AI policy workshop last year and it said business casual. And I show up at the Library of Congress and I'm the only person in jeans and I was mortified. And so I immediately went home and bought these exact pants. They were the only pair of real pants.
I'm glad that we got those. Okay, great.
So I'm scared now when I go to DC.
So East Coast is pants.
Yes.
What is West Coast?
Jeans, joggers.
So like, you just mean it's more casual.
It's more casual,
The conference felt very buttoned up to you.
Yeah, and it was more buttoned up, and people didn't talk about AI that much, which I don't know if you thought people talked about AI.
This is actually so funny because I had the exact opposite reaction, which is one that like I did feel like I was on the West Coast.
Okay.
But I think, you know, the vibe that I got from the conference that I'm like curious about your take on, because you're in the Bay Area all the time, is I react negatively to like homogeneity of any kind of any sort. And when I see that a bunch of people are like really, really dooming about something, I'm like, all right, is it that big of a deal? But I see that they're like really excited about something, I'm like, okay, well, like maybe you guys are really pumping it up too much. This is like classic journalist skepticism, whatever.
Yeah.
And I was like, these people seem like maybe too optimistic about the universe.
They are so optimistic.
But perhaps like too much, right? Like,
I don't know. A little bit. I mean, I was talking to one of my friends who was there, and we were chatting about like, is there actually what is the ideology that actually unifies progress? Because like, I think it was more just like the rule is that you have to have an optimistic vibe, mostly about technology. But like, there really isn't like that much else sort of like unifying the coalition. I think that's enough. What were some of the things people were optimistic about? Supersonic jets, like nuclear fission, nuclear fusion, any sort of weird biotechnology. Like it was like
a
everything.
Lot of biotech,
like, lots of biotech. Biotech's big now.
I think that what was interesting to me about it though is that in this moment in DC in particular, it's a very different doomy vibe. Even for progress-oriented people, which I consider myself among that set. And I think that to me, and when I look at the Trump administration, I see like a lot of like flashing warning signs for progress.
Right? Oh,
like,
yeah.
On immigration, high-skilled immigration. It's possible illegal immigration is going to be at like near zero this year, which is like genuinely very concerning if you're trying to bring in the best AI talent, the best biotech talent from the entire world. Like that's a huge issue. Then you think about tariffs. You think about the problems that local communities are raising in response to data centers, in response to energy projects. And I'm like, this does not feel like really like, oh, we're really excited to like be building the progress of the future. Like there are cities that are potentially stopping self-driving cars because they're afraid of
jobs being taken away from rideshare drivers and things like that. And so to me, I was kind of surprised that that sense of like fear was not present.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I've been wondering about this in general recently because it is strange to me to be in San Francisco at a time when like I do follow national politics a good amount more than the median San Francisco person. Mm-hmm. And it is very stressful for all of the reasons that you mentioned. I don't like what's going on. I think it is very clearly a threat to people's own like desires for technological progress. If you ask about like the immigration situation, like people in tech will admit openly like, oh yeah, it's awful. Like and everybody knows someone who's like gotten stuck in an awful visa situation, someone who's scared they're going to get deported. Yeah. Like people know it's real, but I think there's almost a dispositional distrust and dislike for anyone who's sort of bringing up cynicism and barriers. Because you don't want to be a doomer. You don't want to be a D-cell. I think it's just like such an aversion to having a doomer D-cell mentality. Mm-hmm. And like optimism is seen as a moral value, I think, in the Valley. And so I think people just avoid it. They just don't want to think about it, don't want to talk about it.
This is it's such a good point what you just said, that this idea that like there is a real fear that any sort of potential criticism or even just, hey, have you thought through this potential like unintended consequence of your work? Or like, have you thought through any kind of unintended consequence of your work? Like whether that could lead to, oh, now we've become this sort of like left degrowth ideology.
Yeah. Yes.
And I just, you know, I'm like sympathetic to this concern because like obviously like in my work, I spend a lot of time thinking about and talking about the ways that like very well-intentioned movements, I think particularly the environmental movement, which had many well-intentioned people a part of it, ended up like largely blocking a ton of progress that I think was really important, both for climate goals, but also just human development goals in general. But at the same time, I'm like, it's not actually sustainable to like have like a viewpoint that doesn't countenance any type of measure or measured feedback. And, you know, I had this one conversation with someone where they were talking about dog longevity or pet longevity. And I was like, this is really cool. I have two dogs. I'm like, would love to have them live with me forever. It would be fantastic. I would love for them to have like healthy, happy lives. And then I remember like, you know, speculating like, oh, I wonder though, like, you know, there's a real problem obviously with like a lot of dogs in shelters. I wonder what the knock-on effects would be if it was possible for me to extend my dog's life forever. Like maybe I would adopt fewer dogs. And this person like reacted so negatively to me, like just as someone who was very positive at his project, someone who was like, I have dogs, I would love this product. But then I was like, you know, I actually adopted another dog because, you know, my first dog's getting older and like I wanted to have another dog for her to play with in her old age. And I was like, oh, I probably wouldn't have done that if my dog was just going to be young forever. And he reacted, and this is exactly, honestly, I was very confused by his reaction until you just said that, which is just a sense of like, oh, well, I don't do that. Like, effective altruism, like doomer mentality.
Oh my God, totally. Yeah.
So where do you think this kind of aversion to this comes from? Why do you think there are so many people who are afraid of deacceleration? I think that maybe you've written about the EEC people. What is that for our listeners who don't know about it?
So EEC is like this like originally meme movement that started on Twitter on the internet with this guy, Beff Jesos. That's a pseudonym, pretty obviously. And he started saying EEC is effective accelerationism. It was seen as sort of a counterweight to EA, which is effective altruism, which is a movement that is all about optimizing how to do the most good. And the reason that the EEC sort of got really excited was because there was a huge backlash, I think, over the last maybe 5 to 10 years against effective altruists, especially their work in AI safety, I think, and to slow AI progress down by raising concerns about whether AI would go rogue and kill us all.
Yeah.
And so because these folks ended up being quite influential, for example, in the Biden administration's AI policy environment, they were the ones who supported things like export controls. There's also an alliance with civil rights folks who were really concerned about bias and ethics in AI. All of this sort of led to a more intense regulatory environment about AI, following, of course, like the techlash against Facebook with like Cambridge Analytica. And so there's a sense that these left-wing activists plus effective altruists who actually came oftentimes from inside the tech community and inside the Bay Area and inside AI research labs themselves were raising all of these nitpicky ethical concerns, doomsday scenarios, all which had the effect of slowing down AI progress, technological progress, and preventing us from getting all the incredible utopian things that unfettered progress might bring. And so initially what was an online movement of some like pseudonymous Twitter accounts and then some like prominent venture capitalists like Marc Andreessen started supporting it too. And now you sort of have this like big accelerationist movement in Silicon Valley led by people like Marc Andreessen, David Sachs, et cetera, who basically oppose all regulation and general attempts to slow down technology, particularly when they are raising ethical or political concerns. This comes from having a really strong negative reaction against what was the techlash and the scrutiny of the social media platforms, AI and crypto regulation under the Biden administration, which was seen as a very sort of like Warrenite, like pro-regulation administration, and also a lot of activism from within the companies. I think a lot of CEOs in particular felt really scarred by a period of roughly like 2017 to 2020 when there are a lot of employee movements inside companies like Google around Project Maven and military contracts. Or
what is that?
Project Maven is Google was doing a AI project for the DoD, and they had a contract to do this. And a Google employee at the time, Meredith Whitaker, led a petition and a bunch of resignations, which resulted in a bunch of employee resignations protesting the use of AI for military purposes, because that was something that Google had in the past said that they would be very skeptical of. Yeah. A lot of folks who were skeptical of the U.S. military did not want Google's AI to be used for things like drone targeting. And there are all these employee movements around activism, around Me Too-like things, around also unionization efforts that basically made CEOs really, really like viscerally upset that their own employee base was revolting against them. And they think like, oh, we're paying you so much. We're giving you all these ping pong tables and high salaries. Like, how could you complain about this?
Not the ping pong.
So I think in addition to the regulatory stuff, people were just really mad at their own employees at the time.
Yeah.
And that led to the sort of like in the Trump era, this huge accelerationist intent of, you know, screw all these people, screw all the enemies of progress, screw anyone who's in our way, whether it's a regulator, whether it's an employee, whether it's some like inside whistleblower, it doesn't matter. They're out.
First of all, I think that like a lot of the story you just told, I think is not known or well understood outside of Silicon Valley. I think a lot of people in DC, when they think about, okay, why did the right turn against or why did the tech community turn against the left and against Democrats? Why have they become so supportive of the Trump administration when you see them kind of lining up at his inauguration or people speaking positively of his views? There's like a level of whiplash, right? Because tech was a very left-leaning space. I mean, the Obama administration, there were obviously criticisms how cozy the administration was with executives then. For the large part, like tech CEOs were included and involved in conversations.
Yeah.
You saw
there's the White House Science Fair. Like, there's all this, like, let's get more people in STEM. Like, tech is the future.
Exactly. And, like, learn to code, but positive. You know what I mean? Not negative. And at the same time, there was also, like, a sense that Silicon Valley is a broadly, you know, left-leaning on at least social issues place, right?
Yeah,
like
very,
very open to different lifestyles. And so it kind of makes you more open to the Democratic Party in general. And so I think that a lot of people believe that like, okay, it's because these people are billionaires and they're really rich and so they just don't want to be taxed. I think it has, you know, has some purchase, but I think it's not like fully explanatory because they were rich before, right? Yeah. They became more rich, but like, I mean, what are we talking about here? And then I think there's a lot of people who just believe that it's almost entirely just anti-woke backlash, that like people are really upset, particularly about trans issues. You know, you hear a lot of talk. I mean, I was at the Reagan National Economic Forum where Mark Andreessen was speaking with Joe Lonsdale. Mm. Mark Andreessen, as you mentioned, you know, he's a venture capitalist of Andreessen Horowitz, and Joe Lonsdale is also a venture capitalist. I'm now in Texas.
Yeah, and co-founder of Palantir also.
Yeah, but where's he now?
I think he might be in Austin, but he's these folks are
people moving around fast.
Yeah.
But and Joe Lonsdale were talking, and you know, there was a lot of talk about also about immigration and about how, you know, we've unfettered people across the border, the chaos is unacceptable. I think they talked about like homelessness on the streets. And so there's like in general Inkuit sense where like they seem to have gotten conservative on a lot of issues quickly.
Yeah.
What is your sense of what things are really driving this? Like what moved people, and are they really different than the electorate in general, which we has moved right on these issues as well?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot this year. Why did tech turn right in the last election? And I will make the quick clarification that this is mostly at the executive levels. Venture capitalists, investors, tech leaders like CEOs and executives definitely shifted rightward. I think were voted more for Trump than for Kamala Harris in the last election. I think the rank and file is a very different situation. But
California is not in play.
Yes. Yes. And so I think one part of it is that the Democratic Party and the Biden administration went further left than tech expected it to. Mm. So you're right. Tech has always been socially liberal. There's this really interesting political science research from, I think, David Brookman that actually found some really interesting results where tech executives and leaders tend to be very socially liberal, as we mentioned. They tend to be actually very in favor of taxes and redistribution as a way to equalize the playing field, mm-hmm. similar to other Democrats. But they are more opposed to corporate regulation and more opposed to labor unions than even the median Republican is.
Oh, wow.
Which I think is a very interesting result, yeah. because it's not just a pure libertarianism. It was in the late 2010s. People are at least okay with paying their taxes as billionaires, or at least they say so. What they are really, really angry about is the idea that the government will get in the way of running your business, or mm-hmm. that somebody else is going to tell you how to run your business better than you do, that you are not able to just like do your own innovation. I think it's almost the politics of like, get out of my way and let me cook. Like social liberalism as live and let live.
Yeah.
Over the last 5 years, I would say the Democratic Party has changed a lot. Part of that is the social liberalism evolving into what people call wokeness, which mm-hmm. is a lot less, as Kelsey Piper calls it, live and let live, and a lot more like, this is the one way to think, this is the one way to say. It's a lot more top-down imposed like social norms, which is something that tech has never really been into and became a lot more skeptical of. And then the other thing I will say is that is the economic policy that was pursued under Biden, right? So like appointing Lina Khan to run antitrust and pursuing a very aggressive antitrust strategy, pursuing a lot of scrutiny of crypto and cryptocurrency startups. So Marc Andreessen was especially incensed about debanking, the way that a lot of crypto startups in the Valley were no longer able to have bank accounts or under a lot of banking institutions out of pressure from the Biden administration in the mm-hmm. aftermath of the FTX crash. And then also the AI regulation that was pursued under Biden, again, by a sort of a coalition of civil rights folks and AI doomers or effective altruists who are very concerned about the risk from AI. And so the Biden admin gets much more pro-regulatory and more pro-labor, which per David Brookman is one of the things that Silicon Valley hates the most. Social liberalism evolves into wokeness, which is a little bit more of this like top-down imposition of social norms. And then at the same time, again, you have all of these employee revolts within Silicon Valley companies, which gives people this very visceral sense mm-hmm. of like, these people are trying to get in my way. I've created all this wealth. I've created all these jobs. How could these people be so ungrateful is sort of like the line of thinking that goes there. Those are the forces that shift Silicon Valley elites right. Mm-hmm. And once they are shifted right, they do kind of end up adopting a lot of the broader package of like, yeah. you know, anti-immigration, anti-trans
because
stuff.
It's the dominant thing, yeah. and at least especially on immigration, like it's hard to be part of the Republican Party and have yeah. no answer to the question.
Exactly.
Of, yeah.
You can't be a Republican in general right now yeah. and be like pro-immigration or pro-trans people right now. I don't think it's possible. But like, to be honest, like I would not be surprised if a lot of those sentiments change. And like, I don't think it's a mainstream view to oppose legal immigration, even among Silicon Valley elites. I think you have to yeah. be like pretty far right, pretty far on the extreme end of this to be worried about even legal immigration.
Yeah. There's so much in there that's interesting. And I think new for our listeners. I mean, the first thing I'll say is I think that, you know, some of our Republican listeners may say, well, I'm pro-immigration and I'm still a Republican. I think that I agree with you that largely that seems very, very hard, at least not to be pro-immigration, but you need to at least be okay with what the administration's goal is, which is like mass deportations, mm-hmm. right? Like, I think we recently did polling here at The Argument mm-hmm. about this question of deportation policy. One thing that I felt is that, like, I feel like most of the country thinks that Trump is going beyond what they expected from him. Mm-hmm. But we asked Trump voters this, and the majority of them said no, that this mm-hmm. is what they expected mm-hmm. from him. Obviously, is that them saying, I'm like putting myself back in 2024 and I am now assessing like that mm-hmm. policy expectation to now? No, but it's saying that like they like it or they're okay with it or they find it acceptable. And so that to me is interesting. But the majority is not all. Like there was still a significant chunk of Trump supporters who thought that he had gone beyond and a few who said he's not gone far enough. But to your main point around the regulatory frameworks that the tech elite is kind of in favor of versus what they're not in favor of, this distinction I think is actually really important. This idea that tax and transfer is not impeding your ability to do the thing that you think is actually valuable. Because I think that a lot of people often expect that the real main motivator for people working in these spaces to become billionaires is to become billionaires. It is like that the main goal, that the central goal, that the overriding goal is just maintaining and amassing this hoard of wealth. I think it's often because this is how
that's what headlines say.
True. I mean, there's a lot of coverage that's like that. Yeah. And I think it's also just that, you know, there's a lot of economic populist rhetoric that is resonant with many voters that kind of says like, well, look at the 1%, look what they have, just take it from them. So it makes that very salient. And like, I'm not saying that that doesn't exist, that like people love being rich. I think that Elon Musk likes being the richest man in the world. I do think that it misses that so many of these people are genuinely motivated by trying to transform the world.
Yes.
And whether or not you agree with their vision or whatever that is, that there are things that they view as stupid or useless that are impeding their ability is not something I really fully understood until I started this company, actually.
Oh.
Because when you start this company, I'm like, you know, I'm excited to pay my taxes. I love paying my taxes. Yeah, I think I should pay more taxes. Like, great, let's do it. I want to give this money away to people who need it. Like, yeah. That's if the government is using it to good ends. The amount of regulatory burden that it put on a tiny company, right. Like, I had multiple members of my staff, like, on the phone with, like, California, like, to just attempt to do the right thing. Like, we would like to be in compliance, mm-hmm. but, like, you are making it difficult for us to do this. We're already paying these intermediary companies. And I was like, I now understand why it is that, like, this is frustrating because, like, I'm just trying to post online. This is not, like, a complicated venture.
And most startups start out as one person, like, you know, like, in a co-working space in their living room. Like, of course, like, you look at a Google and you think, okay, Google obviously has a lawyer, so, like, figure all this shit out. But the thing is, like, Silicon Valley's culture is built out of startups and the venture ecosystem, and the thing that feels like most intimate and most close and most visceral for these folks is, how do you help the next generation of startups succeed? And those are going to be two people in their basement, like, eating ramen style, you know? Yeah. And, like, those folks, like, don't have time. Like, they want to be coding. They want to be doing market research. They want to be talking to users. The idea of burdening those folks with, like, figuring out the, like, morass of paperwork that you have to do just to, like, start a very small business at the beginning, that's the stuff that I think really pisses folks off.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think, honestly, like, that there's a level to which people have started to appreciate this. I mean, Annie Lowrey at The Atlantic called this the time tax when it comes to individuals who are on trying to access social welfare programs. Yes. And I think that that's, you know, obviously a very different issue, very, like, much more difficult. Like, if you're trying to access, like, Medicare or Medicaid and, like, sometimes dehumanizing the way you're treated. But I think that, like, there's a similar phenomenon here that you're describing, which is just that, like, you are trying to do the thing that you think is making the world a better place, whether it's something where you are trying to improve AI systems or you are trying to increase human longevity or whatever it is. Many things that people, I think, around the country, even the regulators themselves, would agree they like that private enterprises are working on it. And you feel like the government's against you.
Yeah.
And I think that sense is, you know, really controlling.
No, I think you're totally right about that. And, like, yeah, I think that anyone who has started a small business of any kind understands what that is like. And, you know, like, I talk to folks who are running, like, farmers market stalls in San Francisco who are absolutely not, like, tech entrepreneurs. And I hear about, like, the 9 months of inspections and forms you have to complete just to, like, sell cookies at the farmers market. And it is insane.
Yes.
And so, like, I think this is a broader thing about, like, rules are not costless. And I think this is something that also Silicon Valley feels that DC does not understand, is that when you impose a rule, when you oppose a regulation, when you say fill out this form, it sounds easy, but it is not a costless thing. It requires you oftentimes to hire lawyers. It requires a time tax. Like, and that is the kind of thing that disincentivizes someone from pursuing a big idea altogether. The other thing that you said that I think is really important is that thing about money and billionaires, where, yes, people do want to be rich, of course, but people who go to Silicon Valley, a lot of them do it for the culture and the mission. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that that mission is one that, again, you have to agree with. I'm not saying that people are not power seeking, because people are power seeking. They believe
it's part of the mission.
I am
sometimes
the one who can change the world. I am the one who deserves the power to change the world. They really see themselves as distinct from people who go into, like, New York finance worlds, where it's all about, like, arbitrage and, like, value extraction. Like, no, people actually think there is a vision of society that they have in their brain, and they want to create that world at, you know, maybe substantial disruption and cost, but, like, that is the thing people are really going for. And I've been reporting a lot on AI this year, and you see this a lot with AI. Like, people see the, you know, $100 million salaries that you see the headlines, and you assume that, like, everybody must be working in AI just for the money. What the reality is Mark Zuckerberg had to dangle these $100 million salaries in front of so many, probably dozens of OpenAI researchers who were making much less than that, actually, who turned down those $100 million salaries before he could find people who were going to say yes.
Yeah.
And some of the folks who got hired into Meta Superintelligence actually returned to OpenAI because they wanted to be not at the place that would pay them the most, but at the place where they felt like they were most likely to change the world.
Yeah.
And they didn't feel like working for Mark Zuckerberg was the way they were going to make a dent in history.
Yeah.
And so, like, I tend to think that that desire to make a dent in history, to change the world, to enact your vision of the future is often more animating than just cash, which is, I think, what people tend to think.
And I think this misunderstanding actually flows in both directions, because when I'm on the West Coast, I actually hear this about people in DC all the time, where they're like, well, everyone in DC is just, like, power hungry and they want to destroy, like, all the things that we're doing, and, like, people here are, they're bureaucratic. Sometimes they're like, oh, they're just lazy and no one wants to work and this. And I'm just like, I actually, when I'm in DC, like, the majority of the time I'm running into people who are, like, taking much worse salaries, whether they're in government or they're in a nonprofit or they're at a think tank. And again, similar with Silicon Valley. You don't have to agree with their mission, but these are people who are clearly mission-driven and ideological at some level. And I think that not understanding this as an ideological and mission-oriented debate and fight that's happening is actually really confusing things for a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, like, I was talking to OpenAI researchers earlier this week, some of the folks who are, you know, near the top of the organization, clearly making these giant salaries now. But, like, the thing that they'll tell you is, when I started working at OpenAI, I left quant finance to work at OpenAI, which at the time was a tiny research nonprofit. In the early days of OpenAI, it actually was a nonprofit in like a true way. They had no product. They had no revenue. You went there purely for research and the belief that you were building something transformative and you were going to do it in a safe way. Obviously, OpenAI has become a very different company in the last like 8 years or whatever since it was founded. But for the people joining OpenAI in 2018, coming from the finance world, I do think that those folks did it out of a sense of technological mission. And I believe them when they say that. And now they're accidentally super, super rich and their incentives have probably changed alongside that. But yeah, I do think that if you want to understand Silicon Valley, it is not helpful to sort of attribute everything to pure profit seeking.
Yeah. So I think the part where I like get off the, I get where you guys are coming from boat is when a lot of this stuff has turned to very anti-democratic kind of behavior. And I wonder what you think about this. And what I mean by that is there is a critique of governance, of regulation, of, you know, democratic processes that are actually impeding benefits to humanity that many people have made across the political spectrum. Socialists have made this critique when it comes to the ability to build social housing or clean energy. You know what I mean? Like, this is not something that's like just solely right-coded. But there has become a flavor of this. I don't think this is everyone in tech. I don't think this is everyone in the tech elite. But there's a flavor of this, which I didn't notice when I went to Silicon Valley as much, like, 5-6 years ago, and now I see it everywhere I go, whenever I'm in the Bay Area, whenever I'm talking to folks over there, and you can hear it in the conversations being had in public as well, which is that you actually need to like steamroll over people. And you need to steamroll over whether it's legitimate democratic voices or it's illegitimate processes. Like, that is not relevant. That it's like that anything that's blocking progress has to be stopped because it's like at an existential level, there's this sense. And, you know, this comes from a few things. I mean, some people I think are actually explicitly anti-democratic. I mean, this is a very like Peter Thiel kind of focused view. That this is like an ineffective form of governance. And I mean, this is why I think we see the, like the rise of people like Curtis Yarvin, who is a, you know, Bay Area philosopher kind of guy, I guess is what he calls himself, who talks a lot about the best form of governance not actually being democracy. And like, this guy's been elevated to the point where he did a debate at Harvard with Daniel Allen, who's like a prominent Harvard philosopher. I mean, this is not like, he's not like a fringe guy on the internet. And so to me, like, you know, when I see these ideas getting mainstreamed, and I don't think it was wrong for her to debate him. I think he actually does have some influence and cachet. But when I see these ideas getting mainstream, I'm like, okay, like, how much of this is becoming an anti-democratic movement? And how much of this is like, hey, we'd like to think through regulations in a more sensible way? And I'm worried that it's more of the anti-democratic thing.
Yeah, I think you're right. I do think that these lines of thinking have gotten a lot more prominent. I mean, I will say there were the seeds of this for a while, right? Yeah. So like when you think about the way that Uber originally expanded or Airbnb originally expanded, this was the early 2010s, well before sort of the shift right, they used a tactic that was called regulatory entrepreneurship, which is a very funny, a funny way to talk about the idea of just breaking laws and then like attaining like enough market power that you were – now, at this point, the legislators might as well change the laws to accommodate you because enough people are now riding Ubers that they're going to get pissed if you then go and ban it. But I think like regulatory entrepreneurship has always been a pretty big part of Silicon Valley strategy, whether it comes to ride sharing, like Airbnb type stuff, crypto. It's sort of like if there is a little bit of a gray area, if we can make any case that we are not exactly breaking the law, then we might as well do that first. And once everyone realizes how great our product is and they're so happy to be using it,
better to ask for forgiveness.
Then we'll ask for forgiveness. Exactly. And I think there is a mindset by which people think this might actually be more democratic or more socially beneficial than the alternative. Mm-hmm. Like, I think there is a view that government regulations are not actually democratic things, yeah. right? So I think it comes from a pretty deep distrust of the democratic system broadly, because it is seen as these unaccountable bureaucrats who yeah. are not representative of the broad public and the things that they like and their interests. And so Silicon Valley thinks, well, if we can make a product that a lot of people want, if we can do something very popular, that might in a certain way be more democratic than mm-hmm. actually going through these processes, which actually shut a bunch of people out and are mostly a bunch of, you know, left-wing Ivy League grads who have never built anything in their life. So I think that is like one of the points of view here.
I mean, like, I think that on that, like, yeah. this is the thing I'm worried about is because I have made a lot of critiques of, like, particularly these pseudo-democratic processes
right.
where we pretend that, like, oh, we're doing participatory democracy. Mm. We're getting all these people in the room and then we're yeah. deciding together. But it's like, okay, well, who are you getting in that room? Right. It's like these, you know, really unaccountable nonprofit groups that don't have actually any mass membership. Mm. And then they get to write the laws because you're afraid they're going to sue you. And so now we don't get to have, you know, we don't get to have geothermal energy, or we don't get to have, you know, batteries, or we don't get to have direct air capture plants or whatever. Like, there's all these things that, like, we're blocking. Whereas, and, you know, I think it's hard then to think about what is a better system, because I think it's yeah. how do you incorporate citizen voice without destroying progress is actually, like, a difficult problem, but it's one that other countries have solved. Like, other countries have high-speed rail. Like, yeah. other countries have this, like, and they have democracies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're yeah. democratic, like, countries.
Japan, Spain, yeah. Italy, yeah. like, France, Germany, like, these places have these products. Japan builds tons of housing mm-hmm. in Tokyo, and they've managed to keep rents flat over the same time period that skyrocketing rents have happened in San Francisco. And so to me, like, you know, I think we can learn from these examples and say, like, mm-hmm. okay, we don't have to, like, give up on democracy in order to have this kind of progress-focused view. But I think that, you know, I think that, like, there is a sense that, like, people don't want to do that work. That, like, what they're actually frustrated is that they're like, we don't have time to deal with that kind of, you know, careful rethinking of the process, like, in the way that I think YIMBYs are trying to do on housing in particular. And instead, like, because this AI race is imminent right now, they're just like, we need to just break through before anything stops us.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's certainly part of that. I think the thing that I'll come back to again is, like, a lot of Silicon Valley ideology is downstream of how do you build a company and how do you grow a company.
Yeah.
So, like, almost all of the values, like, contrarianism, respect for, like, great founders and individuals, and, like, this idea of, like, 10x engineers being able to be assholes, but, like, if they're cracked enough, then, like, who even cares, comes from, like, what does it take to build a company? And then a lot of folks in Silicon Valley are then transferring that to processes like government that are actually a lot more complicated, have a lot higher of stakes. Yeah. Because, again, it's okay if your startup fails. Is it okay if the healthcare system fails? Probably not so much.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, like, when, like, Curtis Yarvin, who you just mentioned, this sort of writer, philosopher, one of his core theories is that nation states should be run by CEOs, like tech companies. And I think this is because a lot of folks in Silicon Valley view tech as the only dynamic part of American society left. They see the economy is riding completely on technology and technology companies. And they're sort of like, we're the ones holding up dynamism in this society. And so, like, we're the only live players left in this game. And so, like, if we're the only ones who are actually able to, like, make stuff happen to build the future anymore, how do our companies run? They run with monarchs. They run with individuals who have a lot of top-down control. And I think what's really notable is the lineage between Elon's Twitter takeover, where he fires everyone and starts sort of, like, acting in a very micromanaging or pseudo-authoritarian way about Twitter. And that goes into this founder mode thing that gets popularized by Brian Chesky and Paul Graham. That's this whole movement of Silicon Valley CEOs, many of whom may not be tech right guys, basically saying, oh yeah, like, I am the founder. I am the great man of history. I know how to run my company, and, like, screw the employee activists, screw the middle managers. Like, I'm going to fire everybody and just start taking back control over my companies. And this was a wave after the sort of Twitter takeover that affected basically like every CEO in the Valley. They all started embracing this return to their company. Sergey Brin at Google started coding again once Google got back in the AI race. He was so angry that all of these middle managers had vetoed Google away from shipping their AI products because they were so scared of copyright laws or bias or things like that, that Sergey was like, guys, like, we got to get rid of the woke middle managers and all of you lawyers who are scared of lawsuits. I'm going to come back in. I'm going to hurry you guys up and I will be coding as like the original, you know, co-founder of Google who had left for years. And so I think this precipitates the turn rightward, is this movement of CEOs taking back control over their companies and thinking like, yeah, there's no way that we can actually delegate to the masses because like these bureaucrats and the people are not going to take as much ownership as we are. They don't know how to run a company like we do. And that mentality kind of gets exported into the philosophy around how do you run an entire government? Because they're like, well, Google's a pretty big like corporation. Like if I can run Google, maybe I can run the United States of America. Is that actually true? Oh, I don't know. But
I think you pointed out two things. One is that, if a startup fails, it's very different than if, like, yes. you know, Medicare fails. Like, yeah. that's, like, a different situation for both, like, human progress and also, like, there are fail-safes. Like, if a startup fails, like, okay, like, another startup will come up in its place. That's part of the ecosystem. Yeah. But if the whole health system, like, a lot of people die.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, like, lives are irrevocably changed. But I think also, like, what I had hoped, I mean, you know, I was actually, and I was, like, really got a lot of backlash for this right at the Trump administration started. I had this podcast with Jen Palka, who is someone who's been working a lot on state capacity and rebuilding the government. And we had a podcast talking about, okay, DOGE is going to happen. It hadn't started yet. What is it that we hope that it does?
Yeah.
Like, is there any chance kind of goes in a direction where we can actually reform government? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, Jen she's working in the Obama administration. Like, she's a Democrat. She's a center-left person. And she was, you know, just saying, like, Democrats had no plan for actually making sure that we were going to resolve these problems that everyone agrees exist, these inefficiencies in civil service hiring, these inefficiencies in procurement processes, just all these things that happen in the massive, apparatus of government that actually make it difficult to get the policies done that everyone says they want to do on the Democratic side. And, you know, we had this conversation. We're like, okay, well, like, it would be great if DOGE did, like, X, Y, and Z. Like, there is a chance for this to happen. We got, like, massive backlash for this, obviously. And I think that, like, my reaction to the DOGE experiment was that, like, A, they failed, obviously, right? They killed tons of people. USAID, I think, gutted. And the impact of that is, like, still ongoing. But I think it's also, like, interesting that there's, like, no learning from that. Because my thing is that, you know, I hope still that there will be, whether Republican or Democrat, someone who really does reform these government processes, various ones, especially around permitting and hiring. But when Elon comes in and goes founder mode on the U.S. federal government and says, you know, let's just slash jobs, let's just riff people, let's just do this, and it really won't be a problem. There really won't be some, like, massive negative impact. Or it'll be like Twitter, where it's like, okay, like, some people lose their jobs, they'll get hired somewhere else, and, like, the site will keep on running or whatever. And, like, I think that he feels like, I don't know how he feels, but, like, I would assume that he seems, like, pretty happy with the end product right now, where, like, it's, more right-wing on Twitter than it was before, and that, like, that there's less moderation of many of these kind of right-leaning views on the platform. But at the same time, he clearly doesn't feel like DOGE was a success. Like, he left, and it was, like, a very kind of embarrassing leaving. Like, it wasn't just the news stories that were negative. It was, like, they have nothing to show for it. Did you slash trillions of dollars or even billions and billions of dollars like you said you were going to? Like, no, that didn't happen. And so, to me, I, like, wonder, like, how was the DOGE experiment received in Silicon Valley? Like, was there a sense that, like, oh, people expected more from this?
I think so. I think that a lot of folks shared your orientation at the beginning. Both people in Silicon Valley's right and left and in the middle were all like, you know, DOGE sounds like a good idea. A lot of bureaucracies could be made more efficient. Mm-hmm. Civil service hiring doesn't make any sense and it's not meritocratic. Like, there were versions of DOGE, probably the Jen Palka version of DOGE, that people would have been really enthusiastic about. And, like, I talked to CEOs who were like, yeah, honestly, I would consider doing a tour of duty for Elon. And again, Elon Musk, still, even though he had already started turning kind of right and, like, seemed a little naughty at that point, like, he still retains a lot of respect because, like, SpaceX and Tesla, just genuine achievements, right? He's still a very influential guy who is respected, at least for, like, some set of achievements in the Valley. I think it is true that now people do widely see DOGE as an embarrassment And a bit of a failure. Mm-hmm. Silicon Valley is more tolerant of failure, notably, than probably DC or a lot of folks are out here. And I think that we should be less tolerant of failure when it comes to like the federal government and aid provision and all that stuff. But like, I do think people are really embarrassed right now. I was trying to catch up with some friends who are closer to the tech right than I am, just to ask how people are thinking about the Trump administration 9 months in, 10 months in. Like, do you guys still feel good about this? Like, is this what you expected and more? Like, how do you feel about Elon being out? And yeah, I think the sense is a sense of embarrassment and a sense of retreat, that it was harder than people expected, not just because like, oh, the bureaucracy is actually really complicated, but also like, I think tech really underestimated MAGA and underestimated how much Trump's focuses were the sort of MAGA cultural political goals rather than any interest in the deficit or efficiency. Because I think Elon Musk and a lot of the Doge employees, they were genuinely motivated in part by the wokeness stuff, but also they really did want to reduce the deficit. They really did feel like there was just going to be a bunch of bloat that was going to be super easy to cut. And then it turned out that between cut actual stuff that would like make an impact on the deficit or like increase efficiency versus the cultural stuff, like get rid of all the woke grants to universities or whatever, it was both easier and more politically aligned to cut all the woke grants and cut all the woke aid than to do any of the like pretty hard bureaucratic work of like reforming the system. And so that ended up being Doge's main impact. I don't think people feel that happy about that. I think people think there was a lot of overreach and they didn't actually achieve any of their like fiscal goals either. And so now the tech right is in, I think, a little bit of retreat where people just kind of want to get out altogether. They're like, yeah, like the Democrats are kind of crazy, but like the Trump people are pretty crazy too. They're not actually meritocrats. They don't actually care about efficiency. They aren't really believers in AI anyway. And so maybe we're just going to stop meddling in politics at the national level so much altogether. And so I think it was also about the Republican Party being harder for tech to navigate than they expected.
I'm like curious where you think this is going, because like similarly to you, I'm sort of like, I was expecting the disillusionment, and I think that there will continue to be disillusionment, particularly as they have trouble with, I mean, every single person who works in tech that I've ever talked to has either themselves or a friend who has had trouble with like their visa.
Oh my god.
In order to like, they're like, wow, this like brilliant scientist who wants to come and like loves America and isn't like far left or whatever, like you want to come here, and like they're not letting them, and they it's kind of like a real like scales dropping from the eyes of a moment.
Yeah, the visa stuff really freaked people
out. And I mean, there are people who are like, oh, I just want to bring my family here. And I think there's also like a real uptick on, especially on Twitter, an anti-Indian sentiment, which I think also shocked a lot of people, where they're like, well, I didn't think we meant me. Like, you know,
and like when Sriram came into the administration to do AI policy, and like he's Indian, and people like from MAGA like went after him, and he's like a tech right guy, you know. And so
I expected that, but I also don't really know where that leaves people, right? Because you know, I was at the National Conservatism Conference earlier this year here in DC, and there was, it was really interesting because obviously these folks have allied with the tech right in order to be part of like the broader MAGA movement. There was one speaker who explicitly said, you know, we should be wary of a new fusionism. We don't want to be tied to these people because they don't like the tech humanism sort of fusion idea. They were really averse to the idea that like these like longevity treatments, or that we would be biohacking ourselves, like these
things. The eugenics, though, super baby stuff, embryo screening, people hate that stuff, like genetic editing, like super babies, like all of that. It's all very of that.
I mean, it's very controversial. And I think particularly among national conservatives who are like really, I think, very conservative on this particular issue, even if they are radical on other ones. And I think that to me, it's like, who gets to like own MAGA? It seems like very hard for me to imagine there's a popular constituency that the tech right is going to really own this.
No, I don't think so. I mean, like, I think the core problem was that tech was never a real natural alliance for American conservatives, right? Again, they're such social liberals. They love progress. They love transhumanism. That's sort of like been in Silicon Valley's roots since, you know, the late 20th century. They were united. The tech and the right were united by a shared hate, but not a shared vision of the future, right? Mm-hmm. They hated the same wokes and they hated the same regulators. And so there was hope that they could go and destroy this stuff together. I think that project actually has been kind of accomplished, right?
Yeah.
So they like came together in coalition to get rid of the wokes and to get rid of the regulators and have a more pro-business attitude. But when it comes to like, what does your utopia look like? to Silicon Valley and to the American MAGA right or to the Christian conservatives, those are very, very different visions. Mm-hmm. Like, tech's vision of the future is pretty multicultural. It is a meritocratic multiculturalism where their idea is like, let's take the best AI talent and PhDs and founders from all over the world and bring them to San Francisco.
It's very like elite cosmopolitan.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's very elite cosmopolitan. It is globalist, as like some people would call it, right? And that is not the vision that a lot of American conservatives have. Tech thinks is interested in transhumanism. They want to like screen all their embryos to have the smartest, most healthy, most talented and beautiful babies, and to like, and the idea that technology is something that we can use to perfect human biology and to like make humans more than they are, which is obviously in opposition to a lot of like Christian strains of thought. Yeah. And so I think that there's both distrust, as you saw at NatCon, like from the right towards tech. And I think tech is also realizing with issues like immigration, like, oh yeah, these folks actually don't share values of like what makes Silicon Valley great is this sort of elite meritocracy. They don't actually care about that. Or, you know, things like tariffs, like people hate, like that is not what is seen as a pro-market meritocratic policy. It's not about accelerating technological progress and letting the best businesses win. Yes, the Trump administration is like pro-business, but pro-business in this very corrupt personalistic way where like you just got to be Jensen and like funding a ballroom if you want to like get in the room.
The thing that's gotten me is that, you know, the biggest policies are the ones you just mentioned, like immigration, tariffs are the biggest economic policies of this administration. I think that the question would really be AI policy. Like right now, it seems that the Trump administration has attempted to be significantly more pro acceleration on AI, very much less concerned with safety issues, and also is trying to coordinate at least somewhat with states and localities to make it easier for data center build out to happen. So like, communicate at least this is a priority of the administration, that data centers are allowed to expand here. I think they're going to meet the brute force of NIMBYism, which is a force that no government has been able to match so far. We pulled this. And I mean, also Heat Map pulled this as well. NIMBYism to data centers is worse than like on any other issue. Like it's worse than, I mean, like on housing, which at some level makes sense. Like
if data centers are a very unsympathetic thing.
Yeah. So it's like, how does this help me? Like, you know, exactly. House, like, okay. Yeah. Like an energy project, theoretically.
Bunch of servers.
Yeah, like, what do I do with this? I do think that that's going to be a problem. But I think that like that's really the question here. Because I think that if AI policy doesn't kind of go the way that Silicon Valley wants to see it, and by that I mean like on a variety of issues, I think there was a lot of concern when Trump was going to go recently to negotiate with Xi Jinping in China, whether or not they were going to allow American chips to go
to NVIDIA Blackwell.
The NVIDIA Blackwell. And can you talk a little about that and like what ended up happening there?
The NVIDIA Blackwell chips didn't end up coming up in the Trump-Xi negotiations.
But I think because of the public pressure.
I think a lot of folks are very relieved because a big focus of the Biden administration AI policy was export controls on chips to China. Basically, like, we are not going to give China the compute resources, the chips required to run and to develop frontier AI models. And that's going to be one of the ways that the US maintains a lead in AI. This was sort of based on a belief that AI is going to have this like fast takeoff where at a certain point, AI progress will go so fast, it'll start recursively self-improving and AI will build the next generation of AI. And then all of a sudden we'll have super intelligence and whatever country or organization builds super intelligence first will have a decisive strategic advantage where it will be impossible for the next country to catch up because they'll just be able to like launch such a sophisticated cyber attack using this AI that like the other country will have no way of combating it.
Sorry, folks who aren't in Silicon Valley, that sounds like really like insane, but I want to like really stress this is like a dominant viewpoint among people who work in AI that at AI progress, like once you get to like AGI, you basically have created an intelligence that will be able to create further intelligence.
Yes.
And like that takeoff is what people are, why people are so obsessed with being first.
Yes. Because I think the idea is like once you are first to this milestone and you hit that like inflection point on the exponential curve, you're just going to have super intelligence all of a sudden because like AI is going to be able to invent, you know, Dyson spheres and automate all of robotic production and blah, blah, blah. I think for what it's worth, even in Silicon Valley, even in the AI labs, people are pulling back their timelines a little bit. They're less believing that AI will automate all of the research process at once. And they're like, okay, maybe we'll automate some parts before others. But I think this view of a fast takeoff really informed the export controls, really informed this restrictive approach to AI. And, you know, even in the world where we don't get fast takeoff, AI is still seen as a real military advantage over China.
Yes. I mean, we're seeing this in Ukraine right now where AI is being used by drone technology.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually think the Russia-Ukraine war was a huge update for the defense tech industry, mm-hmm. and part of why American dynamism has really taken off as a area of investment in Silicon Valley is because they're seeing how much defense technology is making the difference for military advantage as well. That competitive, geopolitical, military-first view of AI really informed the Biden admin era. The Trump admin era is – which is led by David Sachs, Sri Ramakrishnan, is a lot more accelerationist on AI, much more, much less focus on expert controls. And the philosophy here is much more of the idea that we actually want the entire world, China included, building on American chips and American models. And that soft power is actually how America will have an advantage. To be clear, Jensen Huang, NVIDIA CEO, has like lobbied the Trump admin an incredible amount, become extremely close with Trump himself. And so a lot of people in Silicon Valley now are kind of like, yeah, Jensen Huang is basically personally setting AI policy at this point. And everything's just about like what's going to make NVIDIA richer. Like they are the first $5 trillion company as of like this week or something like that. And so like, but the stated philosophy is actually that proliferating American AI technology is going to be not a risk that confers this like decisive strategic advantage onto China, but rather it's going to be an economic advantage mm-hmm. because all of these profits are going to come back to American companies like NVIDIA, and that will make NVIDIA stronger. And so that is the direction that AI policy has gone. Of course, like the bias stuff, like all that woke AI stuff is all out. It was kind of funny because what a lot of AI safety folks see as alignment concerns about mm-hmm. having the AIs share human values sort of got twisted by the right into, oh, alignment is actually just woke censorship again. Mm-hmm. It's just trying to content moderate what the AIs can say and can't say. Just like,
yeah, the right was freaking out about the Anthropic Salesforce collaboration because they were just like, Salesforce is obviously extremely integrated into so many businesses' workflows. And that idea that Claude, which is seen as like the woke AI, would be the one doing this. But, you know, we did Kelsey Piper on our team did a great experiment where she like looked at how AI responded. We created a set of 15 questions based on the World Value Survey to figure out like, well, if you ask different AIs in different languages, different models, like what various scenarios, like how mm-hmm. will they react? What kind of advice would they give on things like, you know, what do you do when your son comes out? Like, when is it appropriate to beat your wife? Like things that where like the World Value Survey does register very different opinions depending on the country you're in, because there's different levels of social progress mm-hmm. In different areas and different just viewpoints in general on these issues. We found that largely, no matter what language you're using, no matter what model you're using, AI is pretty libbed out. And I think the reason for that is because it's built on human corpus, like it's a text. And it's the text corpus is mostly written by, I mean, word cells. I mean, like, you know, it's so funny because like tech people were like so, you know, I think very derisive about like word cells versus mm-hmm. what they call themselves shape rotators. And it's so, like their entire product is built on the brain power of word cells to the point where they can't even stop. I mean, Elon wants to stop Grok from being woke so badly.
It's like the Wikipedia wars, right? Yes. Like people are so mad that Wikipedia is woke now. Elon just made his own Grokopedia or whatever.
Yeah.
The thing is like the people who are nerdy enough to like be Wikipedia editors just tend to be liberals also. And so like it's kind of a human capital problem for the right. The other thing about AI that I'm really curious to watch though is that I really expect a pretty left-right populist backlash to AI, right? I think it's going to be motivated by things like woke AI. I think it's going to be motivated by fears of labor displacement, like we're seeing like self-driving cars being banned in Boston. The idea that like, I mean, the AI companies are saying we're going to put all of you guys out of work. Bernie
it's
is like
a very weird message.
It's so weird. It is crazy. Like Bernie Sanders is like really concerned now about AI taking everyone's jobs. Josh Hawley is putting forward that bill to ban the use of chatbots like ChatGPT for minors because of all of these incidences of suicide and psychosis and people getting addicted to AI friends. And like my sense is that among both the Democratic populace who is pretty anti-AI mm-hmm. as well as among left and right populace who are rising in power on both sides, people really do not like that stuff. Silicon Valley and the AI labs are not making a persuasive case for themselves when they say things like, yeah, we're here to take all your jobs.
Yeah.
And I think that like as much as, you know, Jensen and the EACs are able to influence Trump admin AI policy, what's that going to look like in a couple years when AI is even more integrated into American society, when people are feeling a sort of like threat, economic threat a lot more? I am not sure how long a sort of pro AI accelerationist attitude is going to survive. Just
I think this is something, I mean, I wrote about this recently where I was thinking about and reflecting on the way that innovative people on the innovative frontier used to speak about their products and what they were doing versus today. And, you know, you return back to Thomas Edison, where he's like going to Good Housekeeping and he's talking about how electricity is going to liberate women from the drudgery of housework. Like that, he's making his pitch directly to consumers and by extension voters about like why the technological advancements that he's making, which are disruptive and new and like can be scary to people. Like electricity is normal to us now, but like it was kind of freaky to people. I mean, we have all these lights on us right now. But like, I think it's, you know, he was like making the case for why people should be excited about this. And that's a way that like progress functioned with technology like that all the time, where bicycles were like this, where women were so excited about the bicycle being a freeing tool for them to be able to get around without supervision. This was a big suffragette movement. I mean, in Iran right now, the bicycle is seen as a tool of technological progress and freedom. And I think the shift honestly has been, and again, I don't really have evidence for this, but like my vibe is that like VCs are what technologists now have to cater to versus consumers. And so VCs are much more enamored by this sort of like great man of history. We're disrupting everything. We're breaking things and moving fast. Like they're part of Silicon Valley's ethos. Some of them are themselves founders. Many of them themselves are founders versus, you know, if that's who your audience is versus your audience is the future consumer. Because what's interesting is the second the consumer does become the audience, the language changes. Like Waymo ads are actually really kind of
they're safety oriented.
They're like showing moms and kids in the back of their cars being able to talk to each other, family members being able to talk to each other, freeing seniors from being able to drive unsafely on the roads. But it's like, where was all that energy like 5 years ago?
I think the other core audience is recruiting. So like with AI Labs in particular, talent is still the number one thing that they are worried about. And so like when they are doing messaging online, a lot of it is focused on potential recruits. It's trying to create a vision that shows tech nerds like why they should join your AI lab over all of the others that look basically the same. And the way that people differentiate is by having these visions of society. And frankly, like the thing that motivates a lot of like AI researchers is much this more like radical transformative stuff relative to sort of like more mundane forms of consumer benefit, because it is simply true that people who end up getting CS or AI PhDs just tend to be a different sort of person with different values. I mean, like, I've been thinking about this idea a lot of this Silicon Valley values gap, which is like what there is a widening gap, I think, between Silicon Valley, which is a pretty insular world, and the rest of the country. And that is causing these problems where, you know, I meet people in San Francisco all the time who are really excited about full automation. They believe that we actually should have AI. Yes, it'll put everyone out of work, but then we're going to have UBI and then we're going to have a fully automated luxury communist utopia. And like that is going to be so much better. But the thing is, like, most people find dignity in work. Most people do not see utopia as having nothing to do all day. They want better jobs, right? They want higher paying jobs, better like conditions in their jobs, but people aren't that motivated by the idea of having robots run everything. But like a lot of people in Silicon Valley genuinely are. And I think like even things like this AI friend stuff, right? Like, oh, but like if people are really lonely, like why not give them some AI friends? And like that vision to parents and teachers and like normal people, they're like, I don't want my kids making AI friends. I want them to go outside. And so like, this is like sort of why I'm becoming worried about this populist backlash is I'm just like the messaging that you guys, these AI companies are putting out about their vision of the future, whether it's earnestly believe, whether it's to get investment, whether it's to get recruiting, this stuff, when the rest of the world sees it and you're saying, I am raising like billions of dollars to take all your jobs, that is not exciting to people. And meanwhile, like you were talking about like the bicycle or the way that these Edison advertisements used to go, I'm thinking about how I was in China this summer and I was exploring a lot of the Chinese tech ecosystem and meeting with tech companies there. And the messaging in China is still much more of this sort of like tech for good type messaging. Like the advertising is much more focused
Where were you in China?
Shenzhen, Hangzhou, and Shanghai.
And do you speak Chinese?
I speak some Mandarin. Okay. Yeah. Enough to get around basically.
Yeah. And so you're talking this technology. I read your piece about this and I was so interested in it because I was actually talking to someone recently that was concerned that so few people go to China anymore from America since COVID.
Yeah.
And that like there's just, like a massive gap in understanding like what everyone else. What
people are going again though. Yes. Starting like this year, I'm hearing about so many people, especially from tech, who are going.
Did you go on your own?
I went with a group of friends, all of us tech writers. But like I think there's a lot of like China envy now because everyone sort of realized that like China is ahead in advanced manufacturing. They're ahead in robotics. You hear about like clean streets and skyscrapers and like humanoid robots and whatever. And people are like, oh, shoot, like we should go figure out what's going on there. They can build open source AI models that are pretty close to the US frontier. But again, like what was really interesting, we went on these like tours of the Tencent headquarters, for example. It's super focused on AI for climate, AI for education. Like here's all the good that we're going to do in the world. And the other thing is like there is a visceral sense of progress. Part of it is just being a developing country. But like like my grandparents, my aunts and uncles have lived in Shanghai for the past, like, you know, let's say 50 years. And from 50 years of Shanghai, you've gone from like being a what feels like a developing country with like wet markets and shanty towns and like streets full of dirt and whatever, to getting your very first subway systems, to having high speed rail and skyscrapers and gardens and parks that are nicer and cleaner and more advanced than any US city that I've ever been to. Yeah. And like you win a lot of forgiveness and trust, both for from a government legitimacy perspective as well as from a trusting technological innovation perspective, when a person is able to, in their lifetimes, see yourself going from like scooters and bikes to your first subway systems to like this like bike share, high speed rail, like super fast subway. Like people just feel the progress. It is real to them. It is like something they use every single day, multiple times a day. And like they're like, yeah, technology does make my life better. It's not this sort of like weird sci-fi vision of like super intelligence or the machine god. It's like, nope, I can get to work faster now. And like that's really awesome.
I mean, I've been wondering about this because then whenever I have conversations with folks who work in progress, they're like, well, AI could help cure cancer and it could find all these materials that would be able to, you know, advance either manufacturing or clean energy build out or all these things that like, you know, people might care about. And I'm like, but is that what you guys are all focused on? Because I mean, like when I think about this, like from an outsider perspective, who's like not super in deep in AI, and particularly when I talk to people who are even less in AI than I am, they're like, that's not what I see any of you working on. When I go to ChatGPT, what is it that you guys are making? You're creating Pulse so that now ChatGPT talks to me first. You're not like creating a way for, you know, a scientist to actually, you know, cure cancer or cure Alzheimer's or whatever it is. I agree that there are those knock-on effects that may happen, but I do think that you're right that there's this orientation right now in the American AI space. Yeah. And I'm wondering, you know, one thing that I remember from your piece is that the sense of competition that the Chinese scientists felt with Americans, at the idea that like, you know, oh, well, you're gonna do these tariffs on us. Well, we're just like really, really motivated. Can you talk a little bit about like whether you think that is very honestly kind of American?
And I think there's a lot of similarities between China and the US, between China and Silicon Valley, because they're fiercely competitive environments where like people have these chips on their shoulder. They're workaholic environments. Yeah. San Francisco literally this summer discovered 996, which is 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 7 days or 6 days a week as like a working schedule. This was developed by Chinese big tech companies in the 2010s. So they've been on the chip for like a decade. And they it was actually made illegal because so many people started going to the ICU literally they were surveilling and timing your bathroom breaks. Like it was a mandate. It was not like a we encourage you, but like it was a draconian kind of 996 policy of people being in the office for these insane hours. San Francisco has just discovered it. They love it now. SF is like, we're all 996ing. We're all going to work Saturdays. Like, we live in our offices. But China now is on to 007. And Huawei, which is like a famously like workaholic, intense work culture, really pioneered this. 007 is midnight to midnight, 7 days a week, i.e. you wake up and you are on Slack. You never stop working. And we heard this from a few different people when we were in China.
And like in a depressed way or in an excited way?
The two people who told us this were pretty proud of it. I mean, again, this comes from the idea, especially if you're working in what is considered a strategic industry in China, which is usually either AI or advanced manufacturing. This is seen as like there is a patriotic mission about like how can we help China win. We are part of this like blessed national project where we're accelerating national progress in the face of, again, American attempts to slow China down. Like America is objectively and has objectively tried to slow Chinese technological and economic progress down. That is how the tariffs and the export control are frankly correctly perceived by Chinese technologists. And so they have the sense of like, okay, you guys are just trying to screw us over for no reason. Like, you don't like that we have gotten richer and that our standard of living has gotten higher. So like, screw you. We're going to prove that like, despite your export controls, we can build just as good of AI models. And then we're going to give them away for free to the world.
Are they less enamored by the AI takeoff scenario, because there's a zero-sum nature to this from the American side, where they're just like, it's not just like, okay, well, the Chinese discover the first AGI, then we can do ours way better. It's like, there's a belief, as you laid out for us, that like, actually, you'll just be permanently behind. Do the Chinese not believe this? Or at least, is this not a view that you saw when you were there?
I don't think the AI takeoff stuff is nearly as resonant in China. Like, okay. I'm sure there are a couple people who have this belief, but it is not at all, I would say, the mainstream view in Chinese AI.
There's a confusion about like why there's so such hostility to the chips export. Okay, interesting.
I think there's a sense that like there's not confusion insofar as like China certainly, like the US, believes that AI will confer an economic and military advantage.
Yeah.
But I don't think that necessarily has to go hand in hand with this like recursive self-improvement fast takeoff scenario. Yes. Okay. Right. And again, in China, I think they also have a little bit of a different view of like what AGI looks like. So like robotics is a huge part of AI in China. So like when someone says like China's gonna win in AI, a lot of the technologies that if you read the plans are actually about using AI in manufacturing robotics. Some of that is not even deep learning. Those are certainly not these like LLM God model type things that the US labs are focused on developing. And so they have like a little bit more of a broader view of like what fits into a vision of AI. And a lot of it is about accelerating diffusion into different parts of the economy rather than, again, building a single God model that will then self-improve. I don't think I heard anybody talk about recursive self-improvement when I was in China. So I think it was much more a sense of like America seems to fear China's advancement and they are therefore trying to hold us back and we are going to prove them wrong.
I am sympathetic to the idea that we should have export controls on chips. And I think that like while the Biden administration and the Trump administration have had like some similarities on this question, they haven't, I mean, no one's really tried to stop chips from entering China. Like China is getting these chips anyway.
They're like, very poorly enforced.
They're getting them on the black market and it's like they're not even that concerned about the tariffs, it feels like, because of this ability to still get them without real enforcement of these export controls. And so, I mean, like, do you think that these export controls are unreasonable?
I am not an export controls expert, so I'll first say that. But like, I do think that the initial export controls, which were very early, accelerated the development of an indigenous chip infrastructure within China. So like Huawei is now building their own chips and DeepSeek and all the Chinese firms are being encouraged by the government to build models that are optimized for Chinese chips rather than NVIDIA's chips. And so like the view that a lot of folks who critique export controls have is sort of like the fact that we did this like fairly early in what is seen as the AI race really accelerated China's sense of like, okay, the Americans clearly think this is a strategic technology and they're clearly really worried about these supply chains. So we're going to invest everything we can into developing a fully indigenous Chinese chip supply chain. And they're making quite a bit of progress on that. Obviously, they are not at NVIDIA's level in terms of the most advanced chips, but they're moving pretty fast. And so like I am sympathetic to the view that the initial export controls actually may be a medium to long-term risk, so that they were only useful in a world where you have a fast timelines. If you thought AGI was going to come in 2026 or 2027 and that's when we're going to have the fast takeoff, then the export controls made sense because China's not going to have good enough chips by then. And so like the US will have that decisive strategic advantage. If you think AGI is going to come in like 2030, 2035, and you also are like, oh, it's not going to happen that quickly, it's going to be more of a gradual thing. By 2030, 2035, China's chips will be where the US's are now probably.
Really?
And like that, I mean, I can't say for sure, but like they are moving at a pace where like I could believe that in 5 to 10 years, China has caught up its domestic chip ecosystem with the US's. And like that is possible because we weaned them off our chips by refusing to ship any, you know, NVIDIA chips to them. But given that we did the export controls, the US probably should have enforced them a lot more strictly. Because like right now we're getting the worst of both worlds.
You're gonna like kick your opponent.
Exactly.
Like, run away. Like,
but
I don't
China's
know.
Like getting the chips anyway and they're pissed off, right?
Yes,
like that's the
worst.
Like I can imagine a world where we like actually enforce the export controls. Like from the beginning, we didn't like revise the rules like every single year because we like didn't do them well enough. And like in that world, like okay, like China would actually be slowed down a lot more, but like they haven't been slowed down that much.
I
and
find
so,
this so bizarre.
It's just really messy.
Like, that you don't want to enforce is one of the most bizarre things policymakers do. Like,
I mean, I think there's just like some fight internally between like commerce and other folks.
Always,
you know, but like it's, I think we got the worst of both worlds on export controls.
Yeah.
They tried.
Well, Always our last and final question. Jasmine, what is a take that you've heard recently that pissed you off that you want to tell us about?
Oh my God. Okay. So I know we've been kind of ragging on a lot of the Silicon Valley folks and their ideology, but I am a very happy resident of San Francisco. Yeah. I'm very loyal to the West Coast. I love it there. I love the weirdos. And I read this post by Sasha Chapin called He's a Writer. He writes about it's sort of like personal stuff, psychedelic, self-helpy stuff, meditation. Mm-hmm. He's based in the Bay. He wrote a post called The Bay Area's Curse that went viral about how much he hated Bay Area culture because he said we're too unerotic. We don't have enough riz, which is fair.
Unerotic? Yeah.
He used the word erotic like a million times in this thing. And then he goes on this thing about how like all of his female friends lost their 20s to polyamory. And the way that you meet people here is like people are meeting their husbands at gangbangs. And I was like, Sasha, like this is a you and your circles problem. Like literally skill issue. I have lived in SF for the last like 3 to 4 years. And like, I don't know a single person who met their husband or even their boyfriend at a gangbang. Like the vast
that
majority.
You know of.
true. The vast majority of my friends are monogamous.
Yeah.
They are trad in that sense. But like, okay, like if you want to go move straight to Berkeley and hang out exclusively with like the most like rationalist, like woo poly people, and then you're going to go complain about how the entire Bay Area, a very large and diverse place, is cursed, like you do you.
So I grew up right outside DC in Montgomery County, Maryland. So like I like have been in and around DC my whole life, which means like I like know people who've lived here their whole lives, right? But so there are a lot of people who've lived to DC and they're just like, oh, like DC. The only people who talk, they only talk about politics, they're all on the Hill, all they're doing is like going, and I'm like, you are hanging out with like 1% of this entire area, and you're confused why you don't like find other friends.
Exactly.
Get a
like,
hobby.
People will be like, oh, like every time I go to a party, everyone just asks me what my startup is. And I'm like, you are only going to startup networking events. Like literally, like stop going to the VC sponsored like happy hour, and you will have people stop asking you that question. Like I guarantee it.
If you are at a nonprofit happy hour, you can't complain about nonprofit happy hour. Go somewhere else.
I know. So I'm just like, in Berkeley, California, in like the rationalist group house, everybody is going to be poly. But like, that is not the default experience of being in the Bay. And like, don't slander us like that.
Yeah. So. I mean, this actually kind of really ties into a piece you wrote about being agentic.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think is like really, I mean, it's been, some of these words end up being right coded, even though they're like ideas that like many people hold. But like, just the idea that like you have control of your own life and you can make choices. Yeah.
You know what's so funny is Sasha's helping his wife, Kate Hall, write a book about agency that is about to come out, and her writing in general, both of them are great writers whose stuff I usually appreciate, which is why I even like read this post. But I'm like, if you are so high agency, if you and your wife are the experts on being high agency, try moving, try making different friends, like, just like get out. I don't know,
so funny. Jasmine, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. This has been great.
The Arguments production team includes Ranjini Chakraborty, Isabella Pereira, Angela Tracy, Kate Crawford, and Eli Richman. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. If you want to hear more from The Argument, you can become a subscriber at theargumentmag.com.